my whole thing was how I overcame, you know, my failure was staying too long. And I look back now, and yes, those 17 years were extremely formative, and the connections I built. And I always used to joke, because the beautiful thing of working for a company like PR Newswire, and certainly in the roles that I had, was I was a jack of all trades and master of none. I got to work across the entire company. So marketing, sales, business development, product development, finance. And that lesson was better than any MBA could ever have taught me. But I was also chained to it, and I was terrified of what was next.
Today, we are spending time with Susan McPherson. You know the game you play with your friends, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon? Well, today we're playing 5 degrees of Susan McPherson. Trust me, you can do it. She is the consummate connector. Susan knows everyone. But more than that, Susan connects with everyone. There's a big difference there. She wrote a book on it, y'all. Susan McPherson is intentional in how she connects with people and also how she supports them. She is an active participant in the growth of female founders and women-owned businesses. And through her human, social, and financial capital, she angel invests in dozens of women to help them realize their dreams. Over the course of our conversation today, we talked about her entree into entrepreneurship at the age of 48, the ways to build and grow a business, and how to work differently than so many of us have been taught to when we've been surrounded by leaders and spaces that don't look anything like we do. And we talked about the phrase, be careful about doing business with your friends. I mean, let's be real. That message is said way more often to women than it is said to men. Have you heard of the golf course? If you know me, you know my thoughts on this. And it got me thinking, how do we have a personal relationship with someone and then decide to do business with them? Let's find out.
Hey, Susan.
Hi.
We are so excited to be here with you today. Susan McPherson, y'all, you know her. Everyone knows Susan McPherson. Like, if you're not sure if you know her, go ahead, go check. You know her. That's the beauty of Susan's light that she shines so bright around her and the way that she connects with people. And it's going to come out in this conversation, and we're going to talk about all of those things. But it is just such a pleasure to be sitting across from you, even though we are in different states right now. And it's been a few months since we've been sitting across the table from each other, but I'm just so excited to have you here with us today.
Oh my goodness, Erin, I am like getting goosebumps. I'm so excited. You, speaking of lights, cast such a beautiful light on so many platforms and so many rooms. So it's a joy to be here with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we get into it, and I know that when we share this recording, tonight's event will have passed, but I think it's worth talking about because it's such a cool opportunity that you are hosting. Can you tell us what's going on the Susan McPherson
yes.
rooftop
and
tonight?
But here's this between now and 5 o'clock. You're welcome to join us.
We'll push that information out in a different way so we can get it out there.
I'm hosting an event for an organization called We Are Enough that was founded by a just rock star, actually former rocket scientist, Tracy Gray, who happens to also be a venture capitalist. She founded the organization a few years ago, but she's kicking off a campaign to raise $3 billion to literally disrupt the VC world and use that $3 billion to invest in women-led startups and women of color-led startups with the goal of the funding coming from 3 million women, $1,000 each.
Oh.
And once that $3 billion is raised, it will be enough to break that glass ceiling. Nobody can run away from a $3 billion pocketbook, dare I say. So we're hosting that at 5 o'clock. So come one, come all, Brooklyn.
Come one, come all, come one, come all. And I also, what I love about that is the recognition and the acknowledgement of the collective power. It doesn't have to be such a massive investment on someone's part that they are, you know, shifting what's going to happen in their lifetime in order to do it. It can be an amount that is doable. Yeah. And then it means that you're in it. You're a part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can watch the fruits of your labor. I will, you know, add the caveat, $1,000 is a lot for many, many people. So I never want to assume, but I think for, you know, mid-level professionals that have been toiling in the trenches and can step up, this is a great way to really get involved at the ground level with something very exciting.
It's amazing. It's unsurprising that it's happening on your deck because it's incredible.
Well, it was planned long before it got to my deck.
But I think there's a magical sort of mystical intersection because this is so much of the world that you have spent your life in, is a world investing in women, a world investing in the future of what's going on with women-led, women-owned organizations. You are an investor yourself. You are a creator of connections. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about sort of what the world knows you as. And I have attempted to put together this incredibly long two sentences, but I've done it. I've used a lot of commas and semicolons as I do. But two sentences that encapsulates what I feel is the way that the world sees you. And what I want to do from there, as you take that all in, and I really do want you to take it in, because it's easy to have an incredible career and have incredible impact, be a part of who you are, and not to let it really sit with you and think about all that it took to make those things happen. So I want you to really feel it and listen to it. And then the question that I'm going to ask you is, what's the subtext? Meaning, what do we not know about what it took to do all of those things, to be all of those versions of yourself and to be known for this? Because that's where we really get to what this is all about. Okay. Are we ready, sister?
I can back out now.
No, you can't. You can't. I will chase you down. Even if you go off camera, I will chase you down. I will get on a flight. I'll find you on the rooftop. Okay. Okay. So here we go. Here we go. I'm going to take a couple deep breaths because it's a long one, y'all.
Oh, no.
Okay. Susan McPherson is the consummate connector, a founder, angel investor, corporate responsibility expert, board member of USA for UNHCR and the 19th News, advisory board member of The List, Apolitical Foundation, Just Capital, and Altruis, member of the MIT Solve Women in Technology Leadership Group, New York Women's Forum, and Extraordinary Women on Boards, advisor to the several nonprofits, including She's the First and the Op-Ed Project, and a Vital Voices Global Corporate Ambassador. She is the founder and CEO of McPherson Strategies, a communications consultancy focused on the intersection of brands and social impact, the author of The Lost Art of Connecting, The Gather, Ask, Do Method for Building Meaningful Relationships, the recipient of Forbes Magazine's 50 Over 50 Impact 2021 Award, and Worth Media's Worthy 100 Award, and a winner of numerous accolades for her voice on social media platforms from Fortune Magazine, Fast Company, and Elle Magazine, just to name a few. When do you sleep? What's happening here? Hold on, I gotta take a breath. I'm out of breath. When do you sleep?
Well,
Susan McPherson?
I do, and I love my sleep. In my 20s and 30s, I didn't sleep much, but as soon as that magic number hit 40, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to sleep. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm going to be 59 in a month. And there's something, you know, when you have this many years on the planet, you can do a lot, okay? And you would never have read that when I was 40 or 38 or 45. So I want to say I've taken advantage of my time on this planet to really try to do. And it gives me joy to support others, hence the advising, hence the serving on boards. The building the business came much later. I founded my company at 48. So I already had multitudes of careers before that. I often say I've had 9 lives at this point.
What were you doing before you founded McPherson strategies?
Well, the few years before, I was creating the corporate responsibility practice at a communications firm called Fenton. And before that, I was at a company called PR Newswire for 17 years.
Wow.
And I, over those 17 years, there was a five-year stint in the middle when I worked for, I did business development and marketing for two other companies. But through that 17 years, I was very much always the special projects person. So every 2 years, it was like, Susan McPherson, go run with this. Susan McPherson, go run with this. And so I got to do wonderful things like create products, go to China and help us open up our offices in Beijing and Shanghai, partner with our sister companies and our parent company, which was based in the UK. But I never had teams. So I had to do this all by patchworking people together and getting them excited to join me in my effort without having any supervisory role. And I think that taught me this really solid interpersonal kind of ability to work with people who aren't like me, that don't have the same job as me, but then inspire them to get things done.
That's amazing.
So when I was later, when people were like, why don't you run a business? Why don't you start a company? I was like, I can't do that. I don't even know how to create a spreadsheet, really. And so I talked myself out of running my own company for years. It was really accidental when I knew there was a number of people leaving the consultancy I was at, and I knew I needed to find a new job. So I took a few consulting roles in the meantime, plastered McPherson Strategies on the front door, and said, I'm open for business, with the intent of it lasting a few months. Aaron, you may have heard the story. I never would have named it McPherson Strategies if I thought it was going to be something. It's my ex-husband's name, and we broke up in 2003, 10 years before. Thankfully, he's a great guy. However, I would have been a little more creative.
I mean, but also it's a good point that you said this wasn't even supposed to happen.
No.
You talked yourself out of it, and you also probably did this in a way to say this isn't real, this is temporary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So how old is McPherson Strategies today?
10 years this
month. Beautiful. That's so exciting.
Me too.
Is there ever a point over the course of this time where you have finally accepted that you are a founder?
Yes. When I see payroll going out, I see.
You're like, oh, okay. I guess I'm in charge of that.
It's interesting. One of my first most exciting joys of running a company was paying people. It felt, I mean, yes, it feels powerful and all those things, but it also feels wonderful. You know, I hate to use the word reward because people earn their living. But when I can just drop a bonus, like you feel a little like Glinda the Good Witch, you know?
Yes.
I mean, it's not all rosy. Of course, we have, you know, challenges just like any company. And you have, you know, over the years, we've faced, you know, a pandemic and, you know, racial reckoning and all sorts of things that make trying to be a leader and trying to be effective leader and trying to support people very, very challenging. I will say, Aaron, that I think being 48 actually made me better to do that rather than if I had started. And I'm not trying to dissuade any of your listeners if they have a burning desire to be an entrepreneur. But one of the reasons I wrote my book was because over the last 10 years, 90% of our business has been inbound. And I even saw that 6 years in. So what I wanted folks to understand is connections are valuable and they lead to much more than just kind of fun or a great glass of wine or perhaps a speaking gig. They actually turn into business if done authentically and meaningfully. So the connections I made in my 20s, in my 30s, in my good part of my 40s came back. And it wasn't like at 25 or 35, I was like, Aaron, if you connect with me, I'm going to come calling.
Susan was really playing the long game, right? Like you were like, I know this will come to fruition in 20,
yes,
25 years.
Now. I'm saving your number.
I mean, what you have proven time and time and again is that connections and true meaningful connections are not transactional.
No.
And when people view them as transactional, they fall pretty flat pretty quickly because no one wants to be a part of something that doesn't have true, like you said, authentic value and mission-driven sort of meaning behind it.
Well, and reciprocity, you know, and also knowing it is over the long haul and not immediate gratification. We all know when we get those LinkedIn requests and we say yes, and then within a second someone is selling us something.
That's right.
And you immediately go, ew.
Yeah.
Right? And right. It doesn't have to be that way.
That's right. It's like we can build something here. We don't have to go straight into it.
Yeah.
I think so. I'd love to hear how you have navigated what I see so often as a challenge as a business owner with creating the connection, with having a friendship and a relationship and wanting to do business with someone. Mm-hmm. And knowing how to do that, how to navigate when it works and when it doesn't, how mm-hmm. to navigate when there's an opportunity and when there isn't. Because this is something I have experienced specifically as a woman, where the message from others watching has been, well, be careful about trying to do business with your friends.
Yeah.
Because that can be really risky. So what's been your experience with that?
Well, you know, I've had amazing experiences and I've had challenging experiences. But I, looking back, it is much more enjoyable to work with people you care about, that you like, that you have aligned values. But I think much of it comes down to expectation setting in the beginning and setting those boundaries from the moment. And I'm very careful to do that. And none of my clients or our clients, excuse me, are like besties, right? They're colleagues that I've gotten to know and respected and would go have a glass of wine or have a lunch with, maybe even go away on a weekend with.
Yeah.
Would I move in with them? No.
I mean, listen, that's a big deal, okay?
Right.
Most of us wouldn't live with the people who we're living with now, but yeah.
But I just think, you know, life is hard enough. Why wouldn't we want to work with people we really enjoy being around? And oftentimes they're the people that are in our circles, right?
Yes.
But I also, it's important to break out of our circles as well, both on our friendship scheme, but also in our business lives as well, because it makes life a lot more interesting when you are, you know, surrounded by people who don't look like you, don't sound like you, the same age, race, and color as you, right?
That's right.
But I digress. You know, your specific question, I think it really comes down to setting parameters around what the expectations are and then regular check-ins, which is what I would do with regular clients anyways.
That's right.
But I do think that going into an engagement with somebody who is a dear friend, you know, setting that up and also scenario planning and saying, yeah. The obvious, if things go south, I want to make sure we protect this relationship. So let's agree to that and figure out a way, no matter what, that will make it through. And I think regular check-ins on that.
That's really beautiful. I think that communication is that's a savior. That is going to save relationships and business. And people are so often, you know, reticent to have that conversation because they don't want to even assume that it's a possibility. But when you don't acknowledge what could be, you deal with it eventually,
right.
And then you're not ready and you haven't planned for it. And so what have you noticed sort of, you know, over the course of the past 10 years? And it might, I think some of it is based on the fact that you have your own company and so you have a different experience. But also I just think with what's happened in the world in terms of technology and the way we communicate, what has been sort of like some of the biggest shifts you've seen in the art of connecting over the past decade?
Well, you know, I came of age and my first job, there was no internet. I was using a typewriter and I had an ATEX kind of, I was at USA Today, which had the wire services coming in. But if I wanted to communicate with like a coworker who was on a different floor, I had to send inter-office mail in this brown envelope that we would reuse and reuse. And then if I needed to interview someone, I would have the Encyclopedia Britannica and the Yellow Pages to do the research to find out who they were.
Yeah.
Fast forward now, you know, I'm often asked, you know, how do you cold call or reach out to someone you don't know? I'm like, you have everything at your find it out.
You're not cold calling anyone. You know what they had for breakfast.
Yes. You right? can tell if they're upset or angry on Twitter. You can see their entire career trajectory on LinkedIn. You can see if they have grandchildren on Instagram. And yes, you can see what they ate for breakfast on TikTok. So in other words, now it is so easy to reach out to people. And one of my fears is because it is so easy, we have lost the intentionality. So one of the things I think I've seen over the years is, you know, pandemic aside, we have lost what like my parents used to do in the 60s and 70s, which they would splay out today's and yesterday's New York Times and all the local newspapers, and they would cut articles and then go to their manual typewriters and send the articles to people with cute little notes that they typed saying, I'm thinking of you, or this article reminded me of you. But it took intention. It took time. And now it's just so easy to hit zap that I think sometimes we say things perhaps we may regret, may not be from our heart, maybe just not even thinking what we're saying and hitting that button. So I think my, you know, top kind of reflection would be that it has become too easy. And that's good and bad, right?
I mean, that's right. How do you navigate that spectrum of intentionality when thinking about connecting? How do you check in with yourself, knowing that it is so easy to be quick?
Well, this sounds ridiculous, but I have a 15-second rule. I often write it, and then I wait 15 seconds, and I then reread it before I hit send. Okay. And it sounds ridiculous and simple and kind of goofy, but it works for me. And sometimes I make mistakes, but I do think, you know, before hitting that send, with email, with text, with WhatsApp, with Signal, whatever means, take a second to rethink, you know, what are my goals? And certainly with things I put out publicly, I always kind of question, does anybody really care? Because there's so much content.
Oh, so much. There's so much content.
And I, the last thing I want to be doing is contributing flames to that fire, right? Yeah. Good and bad. So I'm always careful about, because I have a tendency to gap, as you could probably tell.
Well, but, you know, here's what's interesting. So 15-second rule, right? That's what you said?
Yes.
Or did you say, okay, because I thought you said 15-minute, which I was like.
No.
Okay. 15-second rule. What I have found, and this is personal, so I'm not saying that's the way that people have to go, but when I am deeply charged and emotional based on something that I am seeing specifically directed at me that would incite a reaction, I sometimes have to wait 24 hours because I am so deeply in it. And what I have to do in those moments is I have to say to myself, what reaction is this about? Is this actually about what's going on here? Or is this just triggering something in me that's old, that is totally separate, that has nothing to do with this? Therefore, what I'm bringing to this is an overreaction. You know, I say 24 hours, but I'm like 24 seconds, which is why I put so much of this stuff out. But how do you handle that when it's not even like, oh, okay, this is just me intentionally and proactively creating a piece of content, but instead reacting to something that is happening?
I still do the 15 second.
Okay.
And people are like, oh my God, that probably takes when you add up all those 15 seconds. But I just think it's important to check ourselves.
It is. Yeah. It is. And we don't have enough mechanisms that do that.
No.
Right?
No.
And so we have to create our own.
Yeah. And I think it's good. It's a good lesson for all of us to kind of just carry around. I don't want to overstate that this is an urgent issue, but I think, you know, collectively, when you have millions of people posting content, if we all just kind of took a step back and reread, and maybe there wouldn't be the vitriol that we're seeing on that one formerly known as Twitter platform.
That's right. I know, whatever the hell it's called now. Like, I'm not paying attention to that. You're right. You're exactly right. And again, when you think about the fact that like the access to create content quickly and to put it out into the world, there is nothing that is inhibiting us from doing that. There used to be so many more steps that it took in order to put things out into the world.
Yeah.
So you said something that I think is so beautiful and I want to dig into because I think it's also, it's complicated. You talked about the joy that you feel in paying people and having people on your team and staffing them. There's so much responsibility that comes along with that as well. And I think a lot of founders who are in their infancy and who are thinking about growing a team, that angst, that nervousness, that trepidation is what keeps them from growing and investing in themselves and bringing in more people. So how did you make that first decision about that first hire?
That's a great question. And I'll tell you a little tip that I think a lot of certainly female founders could benefit from. And I imagine some males as well, some men. So the business kept coming in and I was starting to drown. Again, a good problem to have. And I had a tendency back from always having this fear of being a bag lady because I had had a paycheck since I was 15 and here I was 48. My boyfriend at the time who was living with me had no income. So it was a lot of pressure living in, you know, the most expensive city in the United States. And the thought of hiring somebody else was just like, no, I need to save this money because in 6 months it's all going to dry up and I'm going to have no more. And then I sat down and I had tea with this woman named, and I remember it like yesterday, we were at Columbus Circle in Manhattan, Jacqueline Ottman, who had been a longtime sustainability environmental consultant. And she said, Susan, don't hoard. Don't be like a squirrel. And I was like, what? And she said, it's a generalization, but women have a tendency to think that there's rainy days coming, which of course there are here in New York, but keep the money. And because you don't know, it might dry up. And she said, do exactly the opposite. That is when you want to spend. That is when you want to get out and do what you're good at, which is business cultivation, speaking, being on panels, going around and learning about other people in their worlds. And at that point, I listened to her and I brought on two contractors. And for a few years, everybody was contractors until I realized down the road, long-term, if I ever want to merge with another firm or it needed to be. And that's when I transitioned everybody to employees. But that's how it happened. And it's hard with consulting because it's very hard to predict and to forecast. And, that I would say is the number one challenge of my job is knowing when to hire. Because I never, knock on wood, ever want to have to lay people off. Yeah. If, for instance, we staffed up too aggressively.
That's right.
So I have to pay attention, but you never know because a client can just decide, even though you have a contract, we're done.
That's right.
For no issue that has nothing to do with anything with your firm. But that's a story. That's how we staffed up. Yeah. And we now have 14 people and usually two fellows. So it's exciting.
That's amazing. It's amazing. And it is, I have found my own experience, but also the experience of having conversations with so many other female founders. This is one of the biggest challenges is knowing when to hire, knowing when to invest in what's possible versus what exists, right? And so it's again, that scarcity mindset versus abundance mindset, because when we operate from a place of scarcity, we are limiting ourselves. We are creating barriers for ourselves that aren't necessarily there. And it's not, and what I will say is it's not our fault. We've been conditioned to sort of have this perspective when it comes to money, to have this perspective when it comes to power and success and what we see out in the world. So it's not surprising that we have some trepidation around being bullish with how we fund our businesses and spend our money.
1,000%.
So we see this also with so many of these female founded companies that you have become an investor in. When did that sort of journey begin for you of investing in other women owned businesses?
My first investment was in the Muse in 2011. And part of it was, at that point I was 46, 47 with the realization I wasn't going to be having children, clearly. And I had always been very philanthropic, and I had been learning more and more about the fact that you can actually have, gain a seat at the table, just in complete honesty, as well as have an impact by also investing. I had, and this is going to sound tragic, but my mom was killed in a horrible hotel fire in 1986. And 10 years later, my family got a small chunk for the horror of what she suffered. I never would have been able to retire or anything close to that. But that money I put in stocks and bonds and invested wisely. And at age 46, I realized I could use a bit of that to help women realize their dreams. And also, as someone who was in the business world, I felt it would also help me understand how to be a better business leader. Now, again, this was before I founded the company, but I knew if I started on this road, I would be able to better understand how entrepreneurs were working. So that was, or maybe it was 2012, but that's how I made the first investment. And then it was kind of like a drug.
Where am I going to get my next high?
It's a great way to learn how the insides of how businesses are running. But I also, over the years, I've never just written the check. I've wanted to be a resource and help with the things that I'm good at, whether it's helping pitch media, whether it's helpful building impact into their business. So it was really an extension of who I was. And also the ability to learn more about business and finance, because those were my weak spots. I mean, the last time I took economics was in 1983. Okay. The world was very different then, but also, I already mentioned my issue with Excel.
But it's, listen, girl, but we don't need you in Excel. We need other people in Excel. Exactly. We need you doing other things. But yes.
Well, and that is another lesson that I always pass along. Hire people who are good at what you suck at.
That's right.
And that is what I have done to date. But in terms of angel investing, you know, that is what I have kind of made my mission. And one of these days, I hope there's return because we're still not there yet.
Yep.
And I really try to find sweet spots of a needed business model or a needed business, but also one that has impact. But I also have a very bad propensity to fund women I fall in love with. And I don't mean that.
Yeah, that's fair.
But, you know, that I would not advise to your listeners, but it's also, you know, there's something I get from that. So I'm clearly, you know, this isn't all altruistic. I'm thrilled that I have the means, that I have the privilege to do this. My hope is maybe a couple of them will turn, but in the end, 20 years from now, if none of them do, I've gained from it as well.
What has been one of the biggest learnings that you have gained from this experience with these women? What are you seeing happen in the space of female-founded businesses that has been a surprise to you?
Well, one thing I didn't know in the beginning was you need to keep investing in the same company or you get diluted. And that might have made me be less, you know, shame on me for not learning more.
Sure.
Because, you know, when you make a $12,000 investment and 10 years later, it's worth $238 because you didn't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I take responsibility. I should have, you know, I was so gregarious with just writing the check. So yeah. I would advise any of your listeners to understand, you know, yes, all the risks associated with it, but also the fact that you know, as they continue to raise over the years, you're going to need to either step up or find if there's another exit for you.
Was most of this self-taught when you came into this investing space?
Yeah.
And so have you...
There are ways to learn. I mean, there's AllRaise, there's Pipeline Angels, there are some exceptional platforms out there, which I would encourage people to do before just running and writing checks.
And I agree with that. And I think also some of this is like, it's building the plane while you're flying it.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of this is just sort of, we have to jump into the water somewhere instead of always standing so safely on the shore and missing the boat. That was a lot of analogies in one sentence. So I want to talk about your work on boards because I continue to see so many women who should be on boards who haven't even considered it, who aren't a part of the consideration set. And so how did you break into the world of board seats and when did that begin?
Well, and I want to draw a clear line. The nonprofit boards that I've served on are very different from any kind of corporate board, which I yet to have a seat on. I sit on the board of the list, but, you know, not a private board, not a public board. But my first board was in 2005, was an organization, a nonprofit called the Business Council for Peace, BPeace, which actually propelled me into a world of corporate responsibility. It was the first time ever that I saw business being a force for good in real time. And BPeace was at the time it was founded right after 9/11, and it was a network consortium of mainly women business professionals who were pooling their acumen, their smarts, their resources, and supporting women entrepreneurs in Afghanistan, Rwanda, later El Salvador, and Honduras and Guatemala. I went to Afghanistan with them in 2005, and it was literally worked with Afghan entrepreneurs with the goal of building their businesses. They weren't home-based microfinance entrepreneurs with, you know, just themselves working. They had employees. And our mantra was more jobs equals less violence, which in any region of conflict. But you had, you know, a woman in the network who worked for Marriott that was helping an Afghan woman who had a pension. I was going to say Airbnb, but this was long before.
Yeah, sure.
But then I joined the board. And at that point, PR Newswire, the company I was working for, would then start coming to me saying, oh, you're the expert in where we should be donating our nonprofit funds. And then that became more and more. And I got involved in other nonprofits. And I often advise young people, don't, you know, I wouldn't look at nonprofit boards as a ticket to for-profit boards, but nonprofit boards are extremely valuable for the following reason: learning skills you don't have, learning about subject matter that you don't have expertise in, expanding your network and your communities, okay, and making your life more interesting. Okay. You know, especially people who have, you know, day jobs and then they, you know, maybe have events or things at night, but if they want to be committed and feel like that a bit of just heart charging and exuberance. So that was my first. And then years later, I was recruited to join USA for UNHCR, which is the UN High Commission for Refugees. And every year that I was on the board, I would visit refugee hotspots. So I went to the Syrian border to visit refugee camps. I went to the Lampedusa in the Mediterranean to witness the boat rescues. I went to the border of Venezuela and Colombia when the Venezuelan crisis started. I went to refugee camps in Kenya and Uganda to meet, you know, refugees. And I found those experiences to be life-changing, but also informative for everything I do in the nonprofit sector, in working with our clients. And today we're living at a time where migration is going to skyrocket. I mean, we already have close to 100 million people on this planet who are displaced and don't have a home. And as climate change effects continue to ravage this planet, that number is going to expand exponentially. So those experiences help me really understand what those people, what their lives are, and what I can be doing in my teeny little world to help them. Sorry, that was a Bandcamp story, but
But what I think is so important about it is, I believe many of us get stuck inside of what we believe our career path is, and we have a very linear trajectory of what that looks like. I can speak from experience, having spent 15 years in the agency world, that that was just what I figured my track was. I was on track to just stay in the agency world and just continue to climb that ladder at a pace that was either sluggish or quick, depending on what was going on at the time. When you have experiences like the experiences that you just talked about, when you step outside of your office, when you step outside of your comfort zone and outside of the narrow career path that you have put yourself on or others have expected you to be on, you sometimes learn that there's a whole other side of yourself that you've never even given oxygen to, that begins to fuel a fire.
Absolutely. And you may find something mid-career that you decide want to be what you're going to dedicate to. I mean, I was always involved in nonprofits my entire career, all the way back till I was 21. And that came after my mom's death. It was my way of giving back. And she had worked her life the last 15 years of her life for public television. So I always felt a calling to be doing service, giving back. Yeah. And it was always a great way to meet people outside my, you know, and hence back to the connecting, right? Meet people who aren't like you. Is volunteering at a civic organization or a nonprofit is an exceptional way to expand your borders and meet people who maybe differ than you, but may have similar values. Now, the question on corporate boards is, it still is very much of an old boys network. Mm-hmm. Now, those silos are breaking through various organizations that have started, the Fourth Effect, extraordinary women on boards that are doing what they can. But talk about the importance of building connections. That is how you're going to get on a corporate board.
That is exactly right.
I would recommend to your listeners to maybe start with being on an advisory board of a for-profit first to get your feet wet. And I also recommend creating a board resume of why you would be valuable in that seat, because the buck stops with the board of any organization, both nonprofit and for-profit. But the reason I just separate those two is I thought mistakenly for years that all my nonprofit experience on boards would help me, but I've been told that's not the case.
And you know what? I call bullshit on that because again, like, because Susan, it's like, says who? So this again is like, we have to get into these systems that have algorithms that are human made that automatically count us out. So when you think about Fortune 500 board seats, so often the requirement is you have to have been a CEO. And if we know that the hill is so much higher to climb for anyone who's a person of color, anyone who identifies as a woman, anyone who's a part of the LGBTQAI community, then we know that we are just less likely to be a part of the consideration set. Yeah. So for me, my push to these corporate boards is you need to look at your requirements and you need to expand the definition of what you think leadership looks like.
Yeah.
Because it is homogenous in its current state.
Good for you. Hear, hear.
I'm going to set something on fire. I remember I remember, I think it was 2019 September when it was either Fortune or Forbes came out with their 100 most innovative leaders, and it was 99 men and one woman. And again, what was so wild is that this was right in the midst of Me Too and Time's Up. And so it was just, it was a huge mistake to think that the public wasn't going to respond with frustration and questions. And what I thought was so interesting is the initial response was quite defensive. And it was, hey, we have three, you know, professors who have created this criteria, and all we're doing is we're just adhering to the criteria. And so the rest of us say, yeah, but the criteria is stacked against us. And the criteria is human made. So change it.
Exactly. Well, that's where people like you can make that change happen. I believe it.
It's going to. We're going to make that change happen.
I love it. You
know, so, you know, I think about, you've come back to this point a few times that I think is so interesting. PR Newswire seems to have been like a really formative piece of your life, professionally, personally. And maybe they saw things in you before you saw them in yourselves, because you talk about how they put you every 2 years in these roles of leading entire projects that had no way forward without you. So that to me was like, that was very much you being identified as a founder, right? Then they put you in roles where they are asking you to be the decider of where investments are being made. So again, that shows that you're an investor. So you went on to finally accept that these were parts of who you were. And so when you have a formative experience like that, how do you take it with you, but also leave it?
Well, I actually did an Ignite talk back in 2010, where I talked about the fact that I stayed too long. And shame on me, because I had been through so much in my life at the time, 2010. I must have been 46. No, yeah, 45, 46. And I had gotten through, you know, the most terrifying, horrible death of the woman I loved more than life itself. And I'd gone through a divorce, and yet I was terrified to leave my role at PR Newswire because I thought I was done. And now I look back and I kind of laugh. But I remember doing that talk, and it was a 5-minute talk, and it was a great concept, Ignite. And I don't think it exists anymore, but you get 20 slides, and in 5 minutes you're on a stage in front of 500 people, you know, talking about something. And
it sounds like a TED talk.
But my whole thing was how I overcame, you know, my failure was staying too long. And I look back now, and yes, those 17 years were extremely formative, and the connections I built. And I always used to joke, because the beautiful thing of working for a company like PR Newswire, and certainly in the roles that I had, was I was a jack of all trades and master of none. I got to work across the entire industry. Entire company. So marketing, sales, business development, product development, finance. And that lesson was better than any MBA could ever have taught me. But I was also chained to it, and I was terrified of what was next. When now, you know, I'm like, oh my God, you've started a company, you wrote a book, you've owned a home. It's like, oh, okay.
You're like, oh, no, it's in me. Not only is it in me, but not only is it in me, but it's also out there.
We don't know that at the time.
Of course not. Listen, look, like, yeah. Hindsight is, they call it 2020 for a reason.
Well, and it was all male leaders. It was all white men. Yep. You know, I was like at that cusp of getting to that. I was a VP, but to get to that senior, like, you know, above that level, that wasn't going to happen given the structures they had set. So I knew it was, you know, time to move on.
That's right. So when you think about this idea of overstaying, which we've all overstayed, we've overstayed
every part of our lives.
We've overstayed careers. We've overstayed in relationships. We've overstayed at parties. We've overstayed in a lot of spaces. When you look back and you think about that particular experience, what was the moment you knew when it was time to go that you maybe didn't listen to?
Well, they let me go, so I didn't have a choice. But here's what's funny. The next day, they called me to come back as a consultant.
Wow. Maybe they should have taken my 24-hour rule.
Yeah.
Because, right? Well,
and at that point, you know, I'm such a doer. I had already filed unemployment. So I got unemployment, I got my severance, and I got paid as a contractor for the next 6 months. So, but I was running a conference and it was a CSR conference and there was no one else who, there were already like obligations. So I want to give them credit for kicking me in the pants, but it was a perfect situation because, you know, as I think I mentioned earlier in our conversation, I was terrified of, you know, being sitting on the streets. And so, you know, I came home and I immediately, you know, filed for all the things. And then the next moment I get an email saying, we actually need you back.
Right. I mean, it's that whole idea. I mean, which is, again, like, don't, first of all, just don't fire Susan McPherson. It's a huge mistake because the lesson here is like, you will regret it and you will be so like unattached to your embarrassment that you will actually ask her to come back within 24 hours. But it's that idea again of like, you didn't leave. No. You waited until, and I know, I can't tell you how many women I know that say that being fired is one of the best things that ever happened to them. And yes, let's acknowledge that, like, that is a privilege to be able to say that. And it yes. isn't often a positive experience. But usually it's the cases when people say that it's because they know they should leave and they haven't. And so they have waited for someone else to tell them. And we have to stop letting other people tell us yep. who we are, what we should be doing. We have to listen to that gut instinct inside of us. So I'm glad that you got out because it's meant that you've done all of the wonderful things that you've done since. And I want to talk for a minute about Forbes 50 over 50 because it's an incredible honor. And what was that experience like?
I didn't even know. I was in California for work and I get a text in the morning saying, oh my God, did you see the news? And I was like, what? And then that's how I found out. It was wonderful because honestly, I had never won an award in my entire life. So that was the first time to be recognized. So it felt really, really, really good.
Where was the award ceremony?
Well, they had it a few months later because this was in 2021, which was like a really weird, you know, pandemic-y, COVID-y time.
Yes.
And then it was in the city and Dr. Jill Biden came.
Oh my God. So
it was wonderful. Yeah. No, it was really, really special. And it was a very similar reaction to what happened a couple of weeks ago when I got invited to speak at Reese Witherspoon's big event on October 21st in Los Angeles. And when I went and I looked at who else was speaking, I was like, what? I don't belong
yeah.
in that room.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. So next time you see that, you're going to go, oh man, these ladies are so lucky to be on stage with me. We have to start to shift
Aaron,
this.
You're a gift.
We you have to start to shift this. You, the world keeps telling you over and over again who you are. And it is so deeply important that you know that as well. And the other thing about awards that I think is really important for people to understand is that like, that is absurd, first of all, for that to be the first award that you won, but it is largely based on who even enters, right? You don't win awards if you don't enter. And so you know, it's the Wayne Gretzky quote, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Yeah. And so I remember when I was just back from my maternity leave after my second kiddo, and I won PR News Top Women in PR. And that was my 10th year at my agency. And it was the first award they had ever put me up for. And so it's again, like, I think we have to wrestle with this idea that like that external validation is the truth, because really it's a game. There is a system that's set up that requires that you even throw your hat into the ring and you make yourself a part of the consideration set. And so like, it's wonderful to receive these awards, but it's sure as hell not honoring everyone that deserves them. And so you deserved many more awards before then. You will continue to receive more awards now. And I think we just have to keep ensuring that you believe that you are the things that you are. You're a founder. You're an investor. You're a winner of incredible global accolades. Aww. And you are a woman that women-owned businesses count on to see their potential. Okay. So we could talk forever. I'm like, well, I guess we won't get to the 14 bullet points I have here. That's fine.
I'm sorry. I probably talked too much.
No, it's me. I'm the problem. It's me. But what I would love to sort of wrap our conversation with is this exercise that I think is about women's metamorphosis and transformation. It's about recognizing who we were, who we are, and who we're going to be. And so I'm going to say three sentences to you, and I want you to finish those sentences. You can do it with a word, with a few words. It's whatever comes to you, and it should, don't overthink it.
Okay.
Because it should just be, it should be right there on your heart.
Right.
You got it. Was, I am, I will be.
I was inexperienced. I am a boss. I will be happy.
Yes, you are. And yes, you will be. And we are honored to be along for the ride.
And those were just quick. I probably
could know
much more.
But don't you, like, that's what I love about it is like you're sometimes you'll say it and you're like, oh, wow. Okay. That's something for me to listen to. If that's what's coming to me right now, that's something for me to pay attention to and lean into.
Erin, there's a sense of joy that you give off that enables happiness. Okay. I mean, this was the lightest, most effervescent hour I've had in weeks. It was really, really a joy. So thank you. That's a gift you have. And I want to bottle it and I want to share it with every person I know on this planet. It's really, really special. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. I deeply love, appreciate, validate, and admire everything you do and everything you have yet to do, which is exponential. So when am I coming to the rooftop?
Tomorrow.
All right. So I'm going to book my flight.
Yep. We'll have food left over. There'll be wine.
Excellent. Excellent. That's what we're doing. Susan and I will send you a selfie from the rooftop. Until then, make sure that you are following all the incredible work that she's doing and the connections that she's making, because you're a masterclass in connection. So thank you. Thank you for gifting that to the world.
Awesome. All right, my dear.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for spending time with us today. We hope you feel motivated, inspired, and fired up to take on and burn down that patriarchy. We can't wait to see you again next time. Until then, please do your part to hype women. The Hype Women podcast is produced by Erin Gallagher and Melanie Scroggins. Original score by Alex Yuan. Please listen, subscribe, and rate our show wherever you listen to podcasts the most.